And our preaching text today is Ecclesiastes 5, 1 through 7. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For a dream comes with much business, and a fool's voice with many words. When you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity. But God is the one you must fear. My introduction to the OPC occurred in September of 2000 in Portland, Oregon, where I attended, on behalf of the fledgling Congregation of New Geneva, the OPC received us as a mission work there. There, a young man also stood for his ordination in the Presbytery of the Northwest. It was my first experience of an ordination exam in the OPC. Now, I have subsequently witnessed some 35 to 40 exams over my career, and I have to confess that this still was one of the finest in terms of the questions posed and the answers given. It was a great introduction to the Reformed faith, too. The ordinate was confident and composed and as thoroughly at home in the Bible and the standards as anyone I've ever met. But what's pertinent for our message today is the economy of his speech. He answered almost every question in one or two brief, pithy sentences using language from the scriptures and the catechisms to establish his points. He was respectful, calm, and concise. A kind of momentum developed over the course of the exam so that by the conclusion of it, it was evident that this young man will be approved by acclamation. And he was. He embodies Proverbs 17:27, whoever restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. A cool spirit, not cool in terms of hip, but cool in terms of temperature. Now, in contrast, I've also witnessed an opposite kind of ordinate, also before the Presbytery of the OPC, who was loquacious, hasty, and ineffective. Let me note that it was not only his prolix style that bothered most of them, and his sermon was also weak and missed the point. His answers to doctrinal questions were often personal and anecdotal rather than biblical and confessional. And what's pertinent, again, for our message today is the lack of economy of his speech. Once he sensed that he was in deep, hot water with the men of the presbytery, his answers grew longer and fuller in an attempt to extricate himself from an ever-increasing quagmire. A man caught in quicksand will flail and panic, right? Rather than remaining calm and composed. An economy of motion. Here, for our man, it was his lack of economy of speech. What he failed to realize is that the more he spoke, the more he revealed himself to be unfamiliar with the text and the confessions, and the more he spoke, the longer he took to answer a question, the more reckless he became in his speech, the more he irritated the men as well. His gaining of ground with us bore an inverse relationship to the amount of words he used. Well, this man stood before us on three separate occasions. I admire his persistence, but each time he reprised his previous performance, and each time he was rejected as a minister in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. embodying the proverb as far as I'm concerned. Do you see a man who is hasty in his words? There's more hope for a fool than for him. These two men are a metaphor, if you will, for the point that Koheleth desires to make with us today. As creatures made in his image, God's image, we are under constraint to use words as he does, truly, sincerely, and concisely. Thus, our title for our text today, Concise. And there's several points I would like to make with you today. You have on the inside flap of your bulletin a brief outline, and you can take some notes there as well. 2 points today. Point number one, concise. Our words are not like the word, pertinent and omniscient over all. So, use them economically, verses 1 through 3. Now, up to now, we have traversed the gamut of human activity. The house, the field, the mountain, the waters of the sea, the table, the court of the king, and many others. Now we see a change because we see a change of venue. It is the house of God, the temple in Jerusalem. Do you remember the metaphor for that realm of the lower register, the physical, visible realm? It is, of course, of those things under the sun. Here, now, we are ushered into a place of a different order, the house of God, a place where we enter the presence of one who is from the upper register, the place above the sun. And I hope that you sense the fear of the Lord implicit in Koheleth's words here. He says, guard your steps. Guard your steps when you go into the house of God. What happened to Nadab and Abihu, who offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them? They should have been more guarded. Fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. What happened to Uzzah when he put out his hand to stabilize the Ark of the Covenant when David brought it up from the house of Abinadab to Jerusalem? Well, because they were not doing it according to the scriptures, the text tells us the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him down there because of his error, and he died there beside the Ark of God. Time and again, we are cautioned to guard our steps when dealing with an all-holy, all-consuming God who is not like us. Behold and beware, dear listener. He is not like you. He is not like me. And note the reason for caution. For God is in heaven and you are on earth. This is a direct indication of what we have alluded to before. That is, Solomon is primarily concerned with the brevity of life under the sun, where we are upon the earth. But from time to time, he will overtly, explicitly speak of that place above the sun, that is the invisible realm of the Spirit, the upper register, heaven. And he does so here. And the scene is of a worshiper upon pilgrimage to the temple, which of course had been newly constructed by Solomon. Virtually all of Israel would be able to identify with this metaphor put forth by Koheleth, this story, if you will. On they would travel en route to Jerusalem and the temple, and as roads began to converge, more and more pilgrims would fill the highways and byways. Families, individuals, their pack animals, animals they brought for sacrifice, cacophony on the highways. They'd be milling about and jostling one another. Conversations would be had and overheard. What would a traveler have heard on his way, do you think, besides small talk, the hot weather, the dust churned up by all these people? Thieves and robbers were also an ever-present danger on the roads at that time. The parable of the Good Samaritan tells us of this danger, right? Perhaps that wise pilgrim would recall, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us,' let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason, for their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. For in vain is a net spread in the sight of any bird, but these men lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives." Perhaps you'd hear a braggart boast of his conquests on the way, seeing that prostitutes plied their trade during festivals, or of his acquisition of some treasure or other, since merchants sold their goods too, often stolen, maybe legitimate, right? We have evidence that gamblers cast the lot and enticed the pilgrim with various games as well on their way in pilgrimage, a kind of Fort Hall, ancient Fort Hall, if you will. There were multiple opportunities for sin along the way, just as there are on the road for all of us. But the wise pilgrim would recall, "Desire without knowledge is not good," as Proverbs 19:2 tells us. Desire without knowledge is not good, and whoever makes haste with his feet misses his way. Or Proverbs 4:26-27. "Ponder the path of your feet, then all your ways will be sure. Do not swerve to the right or to the left. Turn your foot away from evil." Linger at any truck stop along the highway, and you'll hear such things, the words of fools as well as the wise. Is there not great irony that, on the way to make sacrifice for sins committed, sin is multiplied? Is it not ironic that on the way to acknowledge that one's speech has been rash and prolix, that one increases that burden? Hanging over this entire section are proverbs like Proverbs 10:19. "When words are many, transgression is not lacking." When words are many, transgression is not lacking. We all know someone who just can't shut up, don't we? Right? Someone who makes it their business to talk and talk and talk. I learned early in ministry, in counseling especially, that some people try and control others by keeping up a steady stream of words, determining perhaps the subject and the mood, the opinion of not just the conversation, right? So, quote unquote, it's not really a conversation oftentimes with these people, right? But controlling the whole relationship with talk. And these are the kinds of people that this proverb is tailored for. When words are many, transgression is not lacking. It is a reminder every day of Jesus' admonishment, "I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give account for every careless word they speak. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." Brothers and sisters, looking behind this whole section of Ecclesiastes here, Solomon has in mind that we indeed are created in the image of God, the Imago Dei. And as such, we reflect the living word by which the worlds were created, and being the only creatures as well who are capable of rational speech. The implications are vast and they are deep. We are sentient beings who think and feel and have souls. And as such, we are able to express the innermost contents of our hearts. We are able to communicate simple and complex thoughts, concepts, in order to create everything from scones to skyscrapers. Rickety paper airplanes, right? Some of the kids folding their bulletins into paper airplanes, to deep space rocket probes. And we can speak and do both good and evil with our words as well. We can make clear or cloudy the will and word of our Creator. In short, as the Shorter Catechism puts it, how did God create man? God created man, male and female, the answer comes back. God created man, male and female, after his own image, in knowledge, righteousness, and holiness, with dominion over the creatures. The fool does not take these things to heart. He speaks brashly, rashly from his own proud and sinful heart. The wise man knows he is created in the image of his Maker, the Word, and as such, his words should reflect him. Do yours? How humbling it is. What if we could go back over our week to weed out and reform our words? Huh? What if we could do that before we came in to confess our sin, for example? What would that leaf bag of weeded words look like? How full would it be? What would be left of solid, righteous speech that will stand the test on the day of judgment? One of the current presidential candidates is infamous for being so incoherent and wordy in her speech that her communications are referred to as word salads, right? Thoughts tossed into the air to and fro with no apparent connection or understanding of the subject under discussion. When words are many, sin is not lacking. What if we could have word sifters instead of word salads, huh? At the end of the week before we came into worship, confessing our sin? Well, know that while our little thought exercise here is sobering, something of this sort is in store for every living soul on that day. So ponder and fear, dear listener. Now, this section ends with what is called a dream aphorism. A dream aphorism. For a dream comes with much business, and a fool's voice with many words. These lines express a Hebrew parallelism. That is, the dream with much business is parallel with a fool with many words. Koheleth is also alluding to the theme of Ecclesiastes, that is, the relative brevity of our deeds and efforts, too. It's a theme throughout the wisdom literature, and the fool does not take it to heart. Job chapter 20, verse 8, puts it this way. He says, he, that is the fool, flies away as a dream, so they cannot find him. Just like a vision in the night, he vanishes. There's the brevity, vaporous, are we? Therefore, what remains for us is to measure our words, to make them few, pithy, and concise. And as we do, we find ourselves gaining wisdom and living in the righteous image of our Maker, the living Word, who created all things out of nothing by the mere word of his mouth. Proverbs 16:23 says, the heart of the wise man makes his speech judicious. That's a great translation of the Hebrew word there. The heart of the wise man makes his speech judicious and adds persuasiveness to his lips. Such should be our approach to God every week. Know into whose presence you enter on Sunday and worship. One reason we cultivate a solemn and pious and holy approach to worship. Know into whose presence you enter. Be aware of his comprehensive knowledge of you and all things, for that matter. And keep this in mind when you give your word as well, which brings us to point two. Point number two, concise. Our sworn will is not like Yahweh's. High and sure above all else. So, humbly say and do accordingly. In the ancient world, the temple was a place to pay what one vowed. Many times we see that referred to in Old and New Testaments. A vow was a sacred promise by oath to pay a designated specific sacrifice unto God for prayer answered, maybe for blessings received, or worshipful acknowledgement of his goodness, And it was utterly voluntary until made, that is. Then it became obligatory, with great penalty for its negligence or failure to pay. The law tells us, Deuteronomy 23 says, if you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay fulfilling it. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. But if you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin. You should be careful to do what has passed your lips. For you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. At the heart of the vow is once more the word, the sworn word of a man made in the image of God. This is why God takes the giving of one's word so seriously. To swear an oath is to bind oneself to the payment of the vow on penalty of hurt to himself if he does not, and he does so in the presence of witnesses and before God. Implicit in it is that with God as witness, God will exact this hurt through his divine providence if the oath maker reneges or slights the payment of the vow. The fool does not weigh the gravity of this circumstance. Proverbs 20:25 says, it is a snare to say rashly, it is holy, and to reflect only after making vows. Reflect before you make your vows, so you do not do something rash and incur the providential judgment of God. How often we have done this is a race, the human race. How we have forgotten the seriousness of the vow and the commitment. How many of us have applied for that student loan, leaving it in a dustbin after graduation, never intending to pay it back, right? Oh, it's only government money after all, right? And oftentimes the government suborns this sin, right? Forgiving student debt, for example. That's why we intuitively just react against measures like that, right? How often have we maxed out a drawer full of credit cards, never intending to pay them? But settling perhaps much later, maybe. How often has humanity vowed to be true to one's spouse in every circumstance, crossing one's fingers behind his back even as the ring goes on the other finger? How many of us have signed a contract of any sort with no intention of honoring it to its fullest intent? Or maybe not at all. My grandfather was fond of the expression, a man's word is his bond. We've heard that often, right? A man's word is his bond. When my grandfather gave his word to do or honor something, you could have the peace of mind that he would keep his end of the bargain, even if it meant he might lose in the end. Even as the psalm says, the man who swears to his own hurt and does not change, he will dwell with the Lord. The man who swears or signs a contract, or makes a vow, or an oath, to his own hurt, even, and does not change. That is, he doesn't try to weasel out of an honest deal when things get tough. As a contractor, when my grandfather looked you in the eye and shook your hand and said, it's a deal, he followed through. A written, signed contract was for clarity and mutual understanding. They were brief, those contracts, simple, to the point, language versus legalese, right? In the end, it was the integrity of his word, however, the integrity of his word that mattered and that followed through. The more we as humans fail in this regard, that is, in being men and women of our word, the more contracts and paper and lawsuits and lawyers we seem to need in order to enforce our sworn word. lawyers are just an index of how this has transpired in our culture, right? Hosea laments this at the fall of Israel, right, when Israel was on its last legs, corrupt to its core. Hosea says, they utter mere words. With empty oaths, they make covenants. Therefore, lawsuits spring up like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field. Does that ring true? Huh? Does that ring true in our culture today? Our field of promises are full of poisonous weeds. But God listens, and in his divine providence will exact a price. We know from the Mishnah that in ancient Israel, the high priest sent out a Levitical messenger, if you will, into the cities and villages of Israel to collect upon the vows made. If he appeared at your door and you made excuses, oh, sorry, I was only kidding. I didn't mean it, really. I forgot. Maybe next week, right? They sent out a kind of Sal and Vito with their rubber hoses to exact payment with interest. It's unclear exactly how these things played out historically, but the righteous man understood that God would providentially judge one as righteous and wise or wicked and a fool for the rash vow. That's implicit here in our text. Why should God be angry at your voice, that is, a man's word, and destroy the work of your hands, that is, your estate? The price would be paid in your estate for your foolish and rash vows. What would God, or what if God, were like us, half-hearted in the fulfillment of his sworn word? Where would we be, huh? For example, the Lord said to Abraham, the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn. By myself I have sworn, right? When Abraham brought Isaac to Mount Moriah. By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. Right? And God fulfilled. He was faithful in fulfilling that vow, was he not, to Abraham? And we have Israel, the people of God, and ultimately the church, the people of God, through the one he sent them. Where would we be without the sworn will of our faithful God? We had this read for us in our New Testament reading today. Let's look at it again, right? Hebrews 6, 13 to 20. For when God made a promise to Abraham, God is covenantally faithful, is he not, in all things? For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves. And in all their disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. People of their word. God, a God of his word. The human party meant to be a man of his word, right? In all their disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. So, when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, and because of that, you can rely on his word and promises too, made to you in the new covenant, right? When God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath. So that by two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. Brothers and sisters, you have strong encouragement to hold fast to your hope, because God is true to his word. Is he not? Is he not? In both the old covenant and the new covenant, every stipulation to perfection your God has made and completed in both covenants from now until eternity, through eternity. And so, for those of us who have fled to refuge to God, take strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us, because like my grandfather, you know, the West has this sense of vow and oath, right? It you don't find in other cultures around the world. The idea of a man's word is his bond. On a handshake, you follow through, because we have the pattern in the God of the Bible in the West. And so, those of us who have fled for refuge to him have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us, because he's going to follow through on every word that he has made in promise to us in the covenant. He is a covenant-keeping God. Ergo, we are to be covenant-keeping men and women as well. So hold fast to that strong encouragement that you have, brothers and sisters. And as you approach the temple each week, figuratively speaking, we come into the sanctuary to worship each week. Take Kohelet's advice. Ponder these things in silence and make your thoughts and your feelings many, perhaps, but your words few. Let us now come to that place then in reverence where we find our covenant-keeping God emblemized in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.